The Senate Interim Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come together. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, all of you know, Memorial Day was Monday, and I had the honor of speaking at the Heroes Memorial, which is in Gresham. I always speak with them, and we had more people there than we had ever had before. And we had the Boy Scouts involved, and the Boy Scouts and the Cub Scouts were there, and a lot of families were there. And I just felt some of the comments I made were appreciated, but I think the one thing that I said is that we have to remember that there are those who died who gave up their days so that we can have our, they gave up their todays so that we could have our tomorrows. And that is so true. And I just felt, it was heartfelt to be there, and I want us all to remember our veterans who have served so well for us and who have given the ultimate sacrifice. Thank you,
Madam Chair and colleagues. With that topic, we're actually going to rearrange the schedule and bring Mr. Willis up and talk about the World War II Memorial briefly, since we are just departing from the Memorial Day weekend. Mr. Willis, you can also tell us how retirement is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I am Jim Willis, and I'm here today as the Vice President of Oregon's World War II Memorial Foundation, and to give you an update on the memorial itself. This memorial was on a list of goals when I became the Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs in 2003. So it took me 11 years and a retirement to get there, but we're there. As this memorial transitioned through both the governor's office and the state house, both House and Senate, it was Governor Kulongowski who signed an executive order that created the Oregon World War II Memorial Task Force. From that task force came the formation of the World War II Memorial Foundation. It consisted of board members and honorary board members, all of whom have done yeoman's work in getting this project started. On June 6, 2012, just 2 years ago this coming Friday, we did the groundbreaking. And 2 years later, we're at the memorial and we're done. So to have raised about $1.2 million in a two-year period of time in this current economy was no small task. But this legislative body, through the people of the state of Oregon, gave $250,000 toward that effort, and our hope is that the memorial we have created will make all of you feel a sense of pride for how we're remembering that generation. So when we remember them, we simply understand that it was a period of time in our nation's history when fascism, Nazism, and Japanese imperialism were threatening the entire world. And in the dark days of 1941, 42, and early 43, the outcome of that war was very much in doubt. But through the efforts of an entire generation, 16 million men and women who went to war in uniform, and millions more on the home front, this entire country focused itself on preserving our way of life. And the group that I like to talk about the best, and I want to just briefly mention for you here today, are how it changed the role of women in our society. Because with the bulk of the men off fighting the war, it was the women who became the welders and the riveters and the painters and the electricians and the ammo builders and the aircraft factories, and it goes on and on and on. And what was an interesting dynamic from that was when these men were gone 3, 4, and 5 years at war, and came home to these women whose role had been completely changed from what these men knew of it before they departed for service, it was probably not the smartest move they ever made when they simply threw her the apron and told her to get back in the kitchen, because they had changed, and they had changed forever. But as a result of that war, over half of those 16 million men and women received a college education. And that group of people created what we now know as the middle class in our nation, and then raised another entire generation based on the values that they had, which caused them to come through the Great Depression. So if you think about these tyrants who tried to change the entire world, had they known what the American men and women had gone through in the Great Depression of the 30s, they would have been better off to have made another decision. So a week from today at 1:30 p.m. on the grounds of the state capitol in Wilson Park, we will dedicate Oregon's World War II Memorial. There will be inscribed on that memorial, in fact they're already there, the names of 3,772 Oregonians who lost their lives in that war, of the 152,000 who served in uniform, and the many, many more who served on the home front. So what we will have an opportunity to see is a piece of Oregon history this coming Friday, when what I believe will be the last large gathering of World War II veterans will occur in the history of our state. There will be people there who made the landing at Iwo Jima. There will be others there who actually made the landing 70 years ago next Friday on D-Day at Normandy. And of course, many more who served on surface vessels, submarines, aircraft, infantrymen, and so on in both of the major theaters of war. And finally, I want you to understand that this memorial is not to glorify war. This memorial is to pay tribute to those who served and sacrificed up to and including their lives. And it is also a teaching memorial. Without getting too technical, I have to tell you that I learned an awful lot about what are called QR codes, quick reaction codes, which young people now can use their iPhones and iPads, and they go up to the QR code, and the instrument they have reads the code and tells them everything you'd ever want to know about the Pacific Theater of Operation, or the Aleutian Islands, or North Africa, and so on and so forth. And there is also, at the memorial, a touch screen which allows you to search the name of people in Harney County, who were the World War II veterans that we have in our database from Harney County, Multnomah County, Linn County, so on and so forth. And then the other part is allows you to search it by theater of operation, what was going on during what period of time during the war. And I tested that just yesterday, and it was working perfectly. So I hope it's going to work great next Friday. But in any event, I want to offer my sincerest appreciation on behalf of the board to you as members of the legislature for your support of this memorial, and tell you that without you, we simply couldn't have gotten this done. And as a way to a small token of our appreciation, I've presented each of you with a dedication coin, which I hope you will cherish and keep. They're very limited in their edition. We did make enough for those that are coming to the ceremony, so the World War II veterans will also receive that same coin. So this has been a labor of love for those of us who did this, and having a father who was a combat infantryman in Europe in World War II, this is my way of saying thanks to him as well. So that concludes my report, and I hope that some of you will be able to make it to this dedication next week. I think you will be very inspired by these wonderful men and women who literally saved the world all those years ago. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
And thank you for all the hard work on this. And yes, let's hope the IT portion of this project works. We could use a success right now.
Yes, it does.
Madam Vice Chair,
question? So I had three uncles and my father who were in World War II. They have all deceased. But you said then that I could, on this interactive whatever it is, they were all lived in Multnomah County at the time. press that and their names would come up?
If they are in the database. If they're not
in the database. Well, how do I get them in the database?
I have a card I will give you as I leave today, and it'll show you exactly how to do that.
That's great.
And they'll be in there forever.
Great.
Senator Olson, anything?
No, thank you.
Senator Cornyn? Thank you again, and thank you for the hard work, and look forward to seeing you next Friday.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
With that, colleagues, we're going to move on to the update from the Association of County Veterans Committees, the Multnomah County Veterans Task Force, and I'll let whoever's in charge bring whomever they're bringing up, rather than go down the list and be wrong.
Thank you, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. I'm Bill Hall, Lincoln County Commissioner, and with me, Heather Miewald, Multnomah County's Veterans Service Officer, and also President of the Oregon CVSO Association, and Eric Belt, Administrator at ODVA. And very happy to be up here sharing the platform with them, because I think this underscores the real partnership that exists between the counties and the state in serving the men and women who have served all of us. When I was chair of AOC's Human Services Committee about 2.5 years ago, we established a Veterans Service Subcommittee, but we were at a crossroads last year, and we made the decision for the very first time in a long time at AOC. We created a new policy committee. We elevated this subcommittee to full policy committee status, and I think that hopefully underscores the importance that AOC puts on this partnership and puts on serving the men and women who have served us so notably. The committee is really focused on outcomes. Let me give you our mission statement, which is the AOC Veterans Committee works together as a collective voice for Oregon counties in an effort to provide the best possible services to our veterans, service members, and families. And we think supporting the work of the CVSOs really is critical. That, and I want to take this opportunity to thank all of you both for recent and ongoing investments in that program. You know, when I came into office in Lincoln County 10 years ago, we had one part-time VSO. And with the expansion money the state has provided through the years, as well as some additional general fund investment, we've been able to beef that up to 2 full-time people. And I get stories again and again of the impact that's making on veterans' lives. You know, you're... late colleague Ben Westland, one line I've always remembered in a conversation we had, he said, you know, an elective office is probably all about one pat on the bat for every 2 kicks in the rear. And these days, if I get a pat on the bat, it's usually pat on the back, it's usually because of the work of our county veterans service officer. So I think I will remember what the chair said, that less is more, so I'll leave it at that. Let the other panel members speak, and if you have any questions when we're done, happy to try and respond.
For the record, I'm Heather Miewald. I'm the president of the Oregon County Veterans Service Officers Association, and I'm also a service officer for Multnomah County, and I was asked to be here to tell you a little bit about what we do as CVSOs. Basically, our job is to guide people from beginning to end through the VA claims process. So it's a fairly complicated process. The VA has a book that they give to veterans, just a freebie book, and it's about this thick, and the book we use is about 4 inches thick. It's a daunting process. Our job is to work with veterans to help them figure out which benefits they may be eligible for and to give the VA a clean claim that can be processed quickly and efficiently and get the veterans the benefits that they're entitled to as quickly as possible. So sometimes I think an alternate job title for us could be VA Sherpas. When we're dealing with VA correspondents, it's English to English translator. We're with them from the from the beginning to the end. So we file the claims, we do all the paperwork, we make sure it's correctly filled out, we help them gather evidence and advise them of the type of evidence that they can use to support their claims. When they get their decisions, we can appeal those decisions if we need to. The counties in the metro area sometimes do hearings, so if veterans need to appeal, we'll be there for them at their hearings to represent them. We write their appeals, and if everything goes well, then we kind of package it all up and make sure they get all their state benefits that they're entitled to, and we're always there to help people through that entire process. And I think that's all that I have, unless anybody has questions for me.
We'll go on to you, then we'll go to questions.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Belt, and I work as the administrator for the Veteran Services Division for the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. In my previous life, before coming to ODVA, I was a county veteran service officer at Washington County, and the predecessor of, after Heather, I was the...
Before
Heather, I was the president of the Oregon County Veteran Service Officer Association. So I recognize the value of the partnership that we have with ODVA and the County Veteran Service Officers. It's a key partnership. It's only been strengthened by the relationship with the Association of Oregon Counties, the establishment of a standalone committee that we've been working on a monthly basis with the AOC and the CVSOs in order to develop strategies that will allow us to work together in common towards supporting the best interests of the veterans and the family members here in Oregon. Recently, we went on a field trip with the Association of Oregon Counties out to the Wasco County and had the privilege of being able to tour the County Veteran Service Office there, as well as a group go to the VA, the vet's home for ODVA, as well as a number of other facilities to include the VA clinic there. I think that was very valuable to see a best practice as a in a rural county, the County Veteran Service Office that has great visibility, works very well with the community, as well as leveraging volunteers to enhance the resources, the limited resources that they have as a rural county. That being said, Oregon has been a top 10 state in terms of compensation and pension being received by the veterans and their family members here in Oregon. Even though that only three in 10 veterans receive benefits from the federal VA. So that leaves us with a great opportunity to reach out to the remaining 7 in 10 that potentially are eligible for benefits. What does that mean to be a top 10 state in terms of that compensation and pension and that means and other benefits that are available from the VA? Well, $2.2 billion from in benefits come into the state of Oregon from the federal VA. That's up from $1.9 billion in the 2010 figures, or 2012 figures. The most recent are the 2013. So $2.2 billion in total benefits, that goes down to $1.1 billion in compensation and pension benefits, which are those dollars, that's cold hard cash that goes directly into the bank accounts, into the communities where those veterans and family members live, that they can spend locally. Improves their quality of life, improves the community's quality of life as that money is being spent and creates an economic multiplier effect. Even dialing down a little bit from that $1.1 billion, that really means $92 million every month comes into the state of Oregon in terms of those compensation and pension benefits. And even even more local, if you look at Senator Olson, Clackamas County, that's $6.6 million a month. President Courtney, $6.3 in Marion County. $9.8 in Multnomah County. For Senator Anderson, Senator Boquist, both in Polk, $1.6 million, and $1.9 in Yamhill County. So that's significant dollars that's coming into the economy and also to assist veterans. In addition to that, they're also receiving approximately more than $900 million a year in health care benefits, having accessing health care here in the state, as well as $128 million in educational benefits. So one small area within the total VA benefits that are specifically oriented towards what a county veteran service officer can do, and providing that expertise that Heather talked about in terms of assisting and being that guide for the veteran through that Byzantine maze of the VA law. And if we had a of course, that's not all they do. We hope that a CVSO has the resources to be able to also act as that no wrong door to be able to facilitate that warm handoff to other services within the community to meet the needs of the veteran. And yesterday we had a veteran summit for service providers. Senator Boquist, we were fortunate enough to have come say a few words to the assembled folks there, and there were almost 300 people there that were service providers throughout the state of Oregon. That attended that, and that will only be able to leverage the resources that are available by making those connections between the service providers, so that we could have maximize those resources. So I was glad to see the assembled service providers, and I think that'll go a long ways towards meeting the needs of veterans going through in the future.
Thank you.
So that's all I have.
Okay. Now let me make my ask. Okay. If you go to page 5, and those of you that are online, this document's online, and I'm going to ask the committee chair or the committee administrator to email the report that you gave us out to all 90 members of the legislature with a short summary. And this is why. I mean, in 2005-2007, and I'm preaching the choir here before I get to my ask from you, right? In 2005-2007, the two presiding officers, one of them in the room now and the presiding officer at the time in the chambers, we started down this road of veterans committees. Let's, enhance the veteran service officer program. And I don't need to tell you, it was completely sold on the issue of page 5 that, the more we can pump money into this program, the more individuals who are veterans who will get benefits. And at that point, we're at about 1.8 of the 10, and now we're at 3 in 10. And the net result from 2007 to 2013 is roughly a $500 million increase in the compensation pension side. So the rate of return that we have gotten with our investment dollars, and they're frankly meager money, as everybody in this room knows, has been pretty phenomenal. For the few millions of dollars we've been able to increase, we've managed to actually increase the benefits coming in by about $500 million. And when $900 million of the overall $2.2 million is in health care, that is really federal veterans money substituting dollars we would be paying under OHA, Health and Human Services, and all that sort of stuff like that. So here's my question, the same question was asked of me by several representatives, I guess, yesterday at that meeting, is that we're at 3 and 10, and we're in the top 10, and it ain't good enough. So how do we get to, what is the number we can get to, and this is a takeaway, because what is the number we can get to in the next 2 to 4 years, and what do we got to spend to get to it? Because at 3 and 10, we're at the low-hanging fruit. I mean, as you all know, last year we were even down to the point asking them to send veteran service officers to retirement centers and places like that and start creaming the crop. So in your guys' mind, and Commissioner, you guys have done this, I mean, that's the question I think we have at our level is if we go find $1, $2, $3, $4 million more, what is our rate of return? Because as we all know, even though it's 3 and 10 right now, we're not going to get to 10 and 10. But there's got to be some goal. You folks have been working hard in this that we can realistically get to. And, let's face it, at 1.5, we've got a $500 million. Mm-hmm. 1.5, mm-hmm. $500 million is a pretty good investment. Mm-hmm. If we could get it to, another percentage point out of that thing, you're talking about another $400, $500 million. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of, and you can comment it right now, but that's the selling point that we need to take to our colleagues and say, look, this is where we are now. But if we put another $1 million or $2 million into this, this is the rate of return that we think we can get, because you don't have the money at OHA and you don't have the money at DHS, but we can get the money under the law from the feds for this. So comments? Thoughts?
Senator Boquist and members of the committee. I agree wholeheartedly. You know, the 3 in 10 is an example of the low-hanging fruit that allows us an opportunity to reach, as you said, not the entire remaining 70%, but a good portion, whether that's 4 in 10 or 5 in 10 within the next biennium. But we do need to have a goal. We have seen what the investment has produced since 2007. We were fortunate enough to be able to distribute $1 million in veteran extended outreach grant monies during this biennium. Too early to see what the results of those that investment is, but I can tell you that a significant amount, about a third of that, was used for marketing. The other portion for staff enhancement at the administrative level to allow folks to answer the phone, make some appointments, to free up the highest and best use of a veteran service officer to meet with veterans, and then the remaining to ensure that the offices were as technologically advanced as possible in order to transition to an electronic claims process, which will also enhance effectiveness. So a great opportunity to be able to demonstrate what that additional dollars has bought and what a greater investment would produce in the future.
Commissioner, you're out in the front lines.
Yeah, I'd echo that. I think there's no magic bullet, nothing really that we're not doing already, just having the resources to do even more. I mean, look at in Lincoln County, where we went from 0.8 FTE to 2.0 FTE and got a 75% increase. If we could put another body in that office, I think we could push it even higher, because our VSO, gentleman named John Reed, Navy vet, 66 years old, works from sun up to sundown, literally. It's right. A passion for him. It's a calling. You know, he says, really, he's healing himself by doing this work as well as helping others. But I spend time in the office with John, and he's, or out in the field with him from time to time, and he doesn't have any slack time. He doesn't have any downtime, and so just another body would do wonders, and I think we could do our share in Lincoln County to push that number higher.
You're looking at, spend a couple $100,000 in Lincoln County, and we got a $9 million rate of return into the local economy. We don't have economic growth and bank accounts doing that right now.
Nope. So that's, I think, a big reason why I just have to show these numbers. And even though we've had some rough budget times these last few years, that's why that's never even been on the table as a potential cut these last few years. Even people who don't get the moral argument of it, they look at the cold hard numbers and say, wow.
Yeah, well, behind the scenes, it's cold hard numbers, and I've been able to sell it. So, okay.
Yep, exactly.
This committee, you have the moral and intestinal fortitude to say yes, but yep. Sometimes our colleagues, you got to give them a little better reason.
I understand, because you've got a lot. I know a lot of competing and compelling, and also quite important interests, but very few cases where you can produce this kind of return.
I invest in the business model. Vice Chair, Senator Olson, I think. Senator Corney. We greatly appreciate it. And any information or feedback you can have of a model or a way forward, because ironically, our colleagues in the House across the way are asking questions. They're starting to realize that, when you can spend $1 million and get back $250 million, they're kind of liking this model. And the question is our way forward, and what would a plan look like that we could present that's realistic and a plus up in terms of doing that to go forward? So that's your takeaway for you.
And let's call in Andy Smith, who staffs the committee for AOC. Do you think we can make this a committee project over the next few months, do some modeling, say, in other words, X number of dollars will equal what further return? Let's do that. We'll do that for you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. With that, colleagues, we're going to move on. Senator Courtney has got to step out for a family matter. And we're going to move on to an update from the task force on the Oregon Resilience Plan. I think Dr. Rubin is here someplace. There we go. So we move from 3 in 10 and good news to what happens when it goes bad. We're back to the doom and gloom committee. Colleagues?
Well, Senator Courtney's already heard most of that, so.
Trust me, I will tell him twice.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Rubin. I am the emergency manager for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I'm the vice chair of the Oregon Resilience Task Force, through which I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon. It was my understanding that with a nice day you wanted about a two-hour presentation, but the best I can do for you is about five. So I actually don't have a lot of prepared remarks. It was more the opportunity to give you an update on where we are and what's coming, and then answer questions if you have any. We initiated our actions in November of last year, assembled the committee, and since we only have a year to work, we got into it pretty quickly, trying to develop, going from the Oregon Resilience Plan that was completed in 2013, trying to look at the recommendations in that, as well as our specific charges in Senate Bill 33, what we were supposed to issue recommendations on, and try to focus on a shorter list of priorities that would at least be able to start the implementation process for ORP. So to that end, we've actually narrowed things down quite a bit. We broke our committee into two informal working groups based on the two broader components of Senate Bill 33, one on more of the built environment, engineering systems, infrastructure, and the other on training, education, public information, and the like. And each group worked on its own set of priorities that we then brought back to the task force as a whole to start building our report. So while we do not have a finalized list, I can tell you that really at the top of what all of us agreed as a priority is to find a home for resilience on a more sustainable basis in state government. The ORP was a one-year process with 169 volunteers. Our task force is a one-year process with about a tenth that number of volunteers, but we can't keep doing one-year task forces and you know, short-term projects if we're going to actually have a resilient state, and that means that's listed somewhere. So that'll probably be at the top of our list, but we will be providing recommendations. We'll certainly cover everything in Senate Bill 33. We've come up with a few additional items, both relating to training and education for the public, whether through the school system or otherwise, but also for decision makers in the public and private sector, response professionals, including emergency managers, and for the built environment and infrastructure, some specific focus on the tsunami inundation zone, which is clearly our greatest hazard in terms of just direct life safety, as well as the more populated areas in the Central Valley, using the same scenario, planning scenario that ORP did, which is a magnitude 9 Cascadia subduction zone earthquake with a lot of shaking, a lot of liquefaction in the valley, major tsunami, and trying to go for a combination of what we have in existing rules, what rules we can change, and trying to provide a combination of authority but incentives to, since we don't have a ton of money to do a lot of retrofits, to as we build going forward, to build in better places and build better quality, as well as to retrofit what we can. We have involved quite a few state agencies who were not already members on the committee, so DOGAMI, DLCD, Education, OBDD, and quite a few other parties. We've taken some direct action just as a task force ourselves, writing letters to Superintendent Saxton, just requesting some information on what Department of Education has in mind for their share of seismic resilience, curriculum side, facility side, and we'll be communicating with the DOGAMI Board of Governors as well, since they have the direct authority to generate rule changes as necessary. But beyond that, you know, we just have a few months left, so you'll be receiving a very detailed report come October, and with luck, we'll be able to move on from there. So that's all I had in mind. I'm more than happy to take questions.
I just have one question. Are there any state agencies not cooperating? Is there anybody we need to kick?
If we get to that point, we'll certainly let you know. But so far, we're getting what we need. You know, everyone's under the same situation. It's like we want to make this happen. There is a very limited amount of money, as we're all aware. So we're trying to make this as win-win as possible for everybody. But so far, we're getting what we need.
And is there a preliminary front runner of where this lands in terms of agencies?
You know, it's open for discussion. All we can do is make a recommendation. We have not come up with a formal recommendation, but the consensus among the committee so far would be in the executive branch. Not trying to tie it to a particular agency, because a single agency is still going to be subordinate or on an equal level with other agencies. But we will finalize that, and then it will ultimately be for action.
Okay. Madam Vice Chair, question. Mayor Olson.
I'm on that committee. It's a great task force.
You know, we are just a doom and gloom committee here, aren't we?
Yeah. So,
that's where it goes. Thank you very much, and we appreciate all the volunteer work that your folks are doing and going forward, and this has been kicked a couple of times, and we're all hopeful that, you know, wherever that bell curve is, it's at least 25 years in front of us. But, you know, a couple times in the last few weeks, I've looked at the earthquake shaking map, and there's suddenly been little blips pop up out across the ocean. It's going, oh, Lord, hey, maybe it's not a good day to go to the beach. Again, we appreciate all of the hard work, all the volunteerism that's going into this, and you're right, it probably needs to go to some level in the executive branch and not the IT.
So, Decker, are we going to meet on the 2nd?
Yes.
And have we figured out where?
It'll be at the Anderson Readiness Center, the same place we met the last couple times. I'm trying to finalize an agenda, and we'll actually have a draft version of starting off our final report.
I do have one quick question. Have we had in, because we had some people come in, how's the, and maybe Senator Olson knows this, how's the liquid fuel people, or I know that was one of the weak links we previously had, is you know, once you start shaking, there's no liquid fuel, and when there's no fuel, there's nothing. No disrespect to our natural gas guys in the back and PGE, it's just after you've shaken the ground, you got to have trucks to go fix it. So that has been, I know, a shortfall, and some of the, you know, we had some people come in and Western Petroleum folks and stuff like that, but it is a problem of where do you get fuel? And
well, Senator, we have that is Dogami did a really useful report on that on the central energy hub within the Portland area. You know, between the ground transport and the pipelines, it's easily one of our greatest vulnerabilities. From a public safety perspective, just within our service area, you know, the combination of transportation and fuels, not just for vehicles but for emergency generators, that's our greatest concern. And even as a fire district where, you know, most people think of fire, water, for us, it's same as everyone else, transportation and fuel. And there aren't going to be any easy answers. Some local jurisdictions are starting to deal with it on their own with just greater stocks of supplies, but actually ODOT was here with the Transportation Committee 2 days ago as part of a joint presentation looking at some of the, you know, examining multimodal transportation and some of their priorities. So we all know it's a major priority. There are not going to be any cheap fixes, but that's way up near the top of the list.
Do we have, I mean, because one of the concerns that was, you know, 2 years ago presented with this, and I guess the point I'm running, is the participation by business, because we had a lot of the business communities, and I think Northwest Natural Resources has even raised the whole issue in the same thing. It's like, okay, if you recognize a problem, you need to have some liability protection to go fix the problem, and that remains to be why we haven't had as much participation from the private sector as we'd like to have. And is there still that reluctance out there?
That's been one of the items brought to our attention. You know, there's only a certain amount that we can do as far as recommending liability protection or even determining whether it's actual liability. I saw there was just a lawsuit brought by insurance for a municipality's failure to act on the vulnerabilities they had identified in terms of climate change. You know, I have no idea whether that is whether that has standing in court. I'm not a lawyer, but at some point you have to reach a greater liability by not doing anything than by saying we've identified vulnerabilities and we just haven't gotten to everything. We know that whatever we identify is going to take a while. On ORP, Northwest Natural, PGE, the large utilities and large corporations, Intel, were very involved in that. We did not have as much involvement from small business, and you know, the private sector involvement was really much more focused, and we recognize that going forward that it's going to continue to be a challenge, because we can do all the infrastructure protection we want. If we don't have effective economic recovery, then it's not going to mean much.
Right. But I guess my question is participation in the petroleum industry. I mean, because that's been an issue from the very beginning, because, you know, Chevron ends out at wherever it is in the Tri-Cities, and ain't going to be anything up north because it'll be underground too, or it'll be destroyed too. So
we haven't personally had any direct concerns expressed to us by the petroleum industry. It's more been a general private sector concern about liability.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, I have one point. We passed a veterans preference bill in the last session. Boley, Commissioner Avakian, is heading up a work group trying to get that implemented between the various bureaucracies that don't necessarily agree with our positions. And so I did send you an email out in some reference that Commissioner Avakian and I talked about. So if you'd look at the email and we could get him some feedback backs, because he's heading up kind of the task force work group trying to get that bill implemented. So if you just check your email over the next couple of days and go over there. Madam Vice Chair, anything?
Well, we're going to... No, not yet.
Not yet. Because we're at the end.
Oh, we're at the end?
Yeah, we're done. Almost. What am I missing?
Did you want to have any discussion? Get ideas?
Oh, I do. That's all right. Secretary of State. I did meet with the Secretary of State's office because they were doing a veterans program type audit, and the question comes up there, is this really broad? It's not like an agency audit, and they were looking for ideas. Council put together all the stuff we'd passed over the last couple of years to give to them, but they were looking for continuing input of places and agencies and programs that we thought they should review for veterans impact. So you have anything jump to mind in which the Secretary of State could
want them to look at?
I spent about an hour and a half with them giving them ideas, but, and again, it's not like an agency audit. It was pretty broad. But there's that, and then there's the Secretary of State looking for guidance of what they should audit, and then the Labor Commissioner on how we think the House bill for veterans preference ought to be implemented. So,
well, that one was passed in 2011, wasn't it?
We did some tampering with it last year.
Really?
Yeah.
I was at a huge neighborhood association meeting on Wednesday night, and I wish I could remember the specifics, but they were very concerned about a person or persons at ODVA, and I assume it was ODVA, who manages money that goes out to veterans, and feeling that maybe there should be a little bit more accountability to make sure that the money is actually getting to the veterans. Mm. But I don't know what that would be in. I mean, we talk about VSOs and the amount of money that comes in that goes to them. Does it go directly to the veteran, or is it a pass through? The VA.
I don't think there's much direct pass through the state VA. I mean, most of all of the VSO stuff is the federal stuff, in which what we're doing is processing the federal packets and getting the packets to the feds. The feds approve it, and then they send a check directly to the veteran. So I don't know, unless it's the conservatorship program. Remember, we had some discussion last session about the conservatorship program.
That could
but it's a homeowners association you were at.
No, this isn't homeowners. This is a benefit that's going directly to the veteran. Somehow the veteran wasn't actually getting it. I referred them to someone else. That's why I don't have all the information here.
Now, Chair, are you sure that it was ODVA or a government entity that was dispersing funds? Because there were any number of nonprofits, et cetera.
No, it was
government entity.
It was a government entity.
Well, if you can get whatever to council, she can follow up on it.
That'll be hard to do, but okay.
Senator Olson, anything else?
I think Senator Olson was at the ceremony for the military museum in Clackamas, and I actually on Tuesday Yes, Tuesday went and saw what they're going to propose. And all of the infrastructure, the shell, is paid for, and they're going to have it. And what they're concerned about is the guts of it, the actual displays and the interactive displays, et cetera. And so there will be a bill that I have actually submitted, but would love to have support on making an ask for some amount.
Was that $2 million?
$4.9 million is their ask, but
they're asking for $4 million. They asked me for $2 million.
Wow,
you must be much more generous than I.
They actually gave me the paper for $4.9 million, so I thought
because they knew he was going to cut it to $2 million.
Yeah.
And I said, you can ask for 4.9. We are the policy, but it's the ways and means that will determine,
right.
You know, the amount. Yeah.
Right.
So I just to put it on your radar screen.
Okay. And the other thing is, if you have bill ideas or other things that you want the committee to do, and we're shipping them all to council here to fill up.
I get a bill idea.
I'll send you a copy of what I sent to Stephen.
I get a bill idea, and I don't know if Mr. Stuckey's going to like me to bring it up, but one of the things we talked about was our heavy lift capabilities in our state for the resilience program.
Mm-hmm.
We have heavy lift capability. Mr. Stuckey, if there's a fire going on, we could call up a helicopter and have them there to disperse water. If we have a tsunami, we can't do that with the many companies we have in our state. So I recommend that we put together the same kind of contract that they have with the Forest Service, so that we can, within 24 hours, have heavy lift capability from Aurora to anywhere in the state if we need to move commodities, fuel, water, emergency equipment.
Like a standby IDIQ.
Yeah.
Without funding, so you have it in place.
Yeah. Is that right, Mr. Stuckey?
Okay.
Because we brought it up. Dave and I met up there at the heavy lift areas. And I thought it was rather amazing that we didn't have the capability for an emergency, but we did for fire.
Right.
And it would be nice to have the contract in place so it's a phone call. Mr. Stuckey can make a phone call, and he's got the capabilities that he needs on top of the National Guard.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. You should put pen to paper. So if we have to direct them to do it, because they want to do it but won't do it.
Well, he's working on it, but...
We're doing pre-event contracting then. It will be our first pre-event contract that I think OE has ever done.
Okay.
He's not being recorded.
Yeah.
No. Okay.
We're done.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, colleagues. With that, we're going to end the Senate Intern Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness and come back in September. Thank you. Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness and come back in September. Thank you.